As he considered the French Revolution and the philosophy behind the French Revolution, British Member of Parliament Edmund Burke observed, "But what is liberty without wisdom and without virtue? It is the greatest of all possible evils, for it is folly, vice, and madness without tuition or restraint." Close quote. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Over the past few weeks, our Wyoming Catholic College juniors have been considering the French Revolution with their professor, Dr. Pavlos Papadopoulos. I asked Dr. Papadopoulos about the nature of that revolution. Dr. Papadopoulos, France in the 1780s was rather a mess, socially, politically, economically, religiously. Wasn't it just a matter of time before something had to give?
I think it was. And one of the greatest analysts of the French Revolution, Alexis de Tocqueville, who writes a work called The Old Regime and the Revolution, sees this, and many observers see this as a critical moment when something would have to give. What's interesting, of course, is how France got to this point and the character of the revolution as it unfolded, and whether the way in which it unfolded was inevitable. Tocqueville, his argument in a way is that the most important revolution was the revolution before the revolution, that the centralization of power under the monarchy in Versailles in the century before the French Revolution was the true and most revolutionary event of France in this period. Tocqueville argues in The Old Regime and the Revolution that starting especially with Louis XIV, the Sun King, and going on through the 18th century, the old medieval, feudal, decentralized order of France was wiped away, and all power was concentrated at the court in Versailles under the king. And by the time we get to Louis XVI, the young king of France, at the outbreak of the French Revolution, we have already had a totally centralized state, weakened political traditions or abolished political traditions going back centuries into medieval French history. And what in effect happened was there was a great crisis, political, social, and economic. Louis XVI struggled and was not the right man for the times in terms of his insecurities, his inexperience, his failure to make clear and decisive decisions, his maybe lack of imagination, his distractions. All of those things contributed to a poor response to the crises of France in the 1780s and 1770s. And Tocqueville's argument, however, is that there was already a total state established in France. It happened to be under the monarchy. Once the king was gotten rid of in the course of the revolution, in a couple years into the revolutionary process, that total central state was simply replaced. The authority at the top of that total central state was simply replaced by the National Assembly, and then by the Council of Public Safety, and then eventually by Napoleon. So there's a way in which the Great Revolution already happened, which was that medieval France, and its very complicated and ancient and decentralized system of governance was largely abolished in favor of a central state. That wasn't entirely and cleanly accomplished. There was still the king was still in some way dependent upon the estates and the parlements, the sort of regional bodies throughout France, for just paying for the state and for running the state. And so it wasn't a clean transition, but France had already lost the centuries-old institutions that enabled it to have a somewhat more just government, that enabled its people to be somewhat more realistic in their political judgment. And then once you got rid of the king at the top of that, you had the people or the body pretending to represent the people with a kind of unrestrained power governing France.
Now, the revolutionary motto, liberté, égalité, fraternité, liberty, equality, and brotherhood, that seems like a really good idea, one that we can get behind. What went wrong?
What did go wrong? What didn't go wrong? Yes. And we find actually Edmund Burke in his Reflections of the Revolution in France is pretty clear that liberty, rightly understood, equality, rightly understood, and fraternity, brotherhood, rightly understood, these are all wonderful things, and these are all things that other nations and other regimes aim at and have embodied in ways more perfectly, let's say, than revolutionary France. What went wrong? The French, By the end of the 18th century, the French did not have political experience. This is again Tocqueville's argument in The Old Regime and the Revolution, that in France, because of the centralized state, because of the centralized administration, because all local officials with real power were appointed by the central authority at Versailles, very few people in France had any experience with governing by the time the French Revolution came about. And worse than that, no one in France had experience with the rough and tumble of political debate. Now, the reason why this is important is that that rough and tumble of political debate and that immersion in real contingencies and experiences that political self-government gives to a nation, that sort of shaves off the edges of all of the wild theories that one might have about the best form of government, that one might have about the true nature of society and politics. So concurrent with France losing its political liberty in the decades before, in the centuries before the French Revolution, concurrent with France losing political experience, there was also, France happened to be the heart of the European Enlightenment. And so it's this unique combination of a total lack of experience and a great flowering of thought, of speculative thought about politics, that births what Tocqueville refers to as literary politics. So everyone is a philosopher. No one has any experience with political matters. Everyone is cooking up newer and more appealing in certain ways, more beautiful on paper, ideas about what society is, how society should be run. And yet no one has the experience to sort of temper their theorizing through the rough and tumble of real life. And it's a kind of juxtaposition between the wreck of all of the old and chaotic institutions of medieval France that are still around in some decrepit way. A Frenchman looking from his page where he's reading Rousseau, or he's reading Voltaire, or he's reading Diderot, or he's reading any of these other Enlightenment philosophers who are laying out with what seemed to be crystal clear reasoning, the true rights and duties of man and the true way to erect a just government. When he turns his eye from those pages to look at the dysfunction and the decrepitude of the institutions around him, he would be filled with disgust. And he would just desire to, as Tocqueville says, wipe away all customs and institute a regime based only on what he thinks to be natural law or what reason could discover. And so that was the temptation, and that was what was taken up in the pursuit of these apparently noble goals, if rightly understood, of true liberty, of true equality among men, and of true brotherhood among men.
Now, when we think of the French Revolution, most of us think of the guillotine and the terror, and for good reason. How did the revolution become the reign of terror? And how did the philosophies fit into that?
It became the reign of terror by several stages, but at the beginning of the French Revolution, actually, there was a period of time when the king was still king, but the ambition initially by the three estates, the Estates General, was to create a constitutional monarchy. And there may have actually been a way in which this could have been accomplished to the good of France and to the protection of the church and to the protection of the monarchy on the British model. And a few people were looking at Great Britain or England as a model for this. However, the Estates General, which is the three estates, the commoners, the nobles, and the clergy, each being represented in this body, when they were convoked and assembled by the king in 1789, what immediately happened was a great deal of frustration that had been building up for a decade at least poured out from the different classes. And the third estate, the commoners in particular, refused to be counted, refused to be enrolled, refused to take roll call unless all three estates were combined together into one national assembly. And with that arrangement, the commoners, would have much more say, as opposed to themselves coming to a resolution and then the clergy coming to a different resolution and the nobles coming to a different resolution and the king sort of picking them between them. And so they refused to be seated unless they were all seated together. They sort of seceded from the Estates General and created their own body, which they called the National Assembly. The king indecisively eventually gave in to this demand. And I think they smelled blood in the water, and they started to push for more and more radical proposals. Now, again, the leading men in these bodies at this time, many of them were highly cultured, but highly inexperienced with practical matters. And so they began, when they composed the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, which is the great revolutionary document from the National Assembly, they incorporated elements of Rousseau's political philosophy sort of willy-nilly with other principles that were in the air. One of those principles from Rousseau is that the general will is the will of the people. The whole nation speaks through the assembly. The assembly is the only and total and perfect embodiment of the will of the people. And what the general will says is law. There's no sense anymore of a higher law checking human law. There's no sense of a natural law as a standard for human law. There are rights of man that in some way are natural, but once we are gathered together in an assembly, we can speak authoritatively and without limit on what is right and wrong. And in this environment, the other European nations started to become very nervous. Some of the more radical elements of the French Revolution started cracking down on Catholicism, on the church in France. They started to provoke revolts, particularly in the Vendée, and all kinds of discontent throughout the country. And then that kicked off a process of the National Assembly and eventually the Committee on Public Safety looking harder and harder for enemies of their new revolutionary regime. The king became very worried and tried to flee the country and was caught and returned. In that environment, those holding power in the revolutionary government became more and more suspicious, more and more insecure in their power, more and more paranoid. And eventually they started appealing to these wonderful rhetorical turns of phrase about how terror is going to be what restores virtue to our republic. And it's only through the blood of all of these backwards elements in the church and in the republic, or in the monarchical and noble regime, it's only through the cleansing of France, through all of that blood that will flow from the guillotine, that we'll be able to actually achieve our revolutionary goals.
Now, what do our students make of all this, and what do they take away from it?
Well, it was a delightful few days to spend. We study this in the context of a junior humanities class that begins with Francis Bacon, René Descartes, and John Milton, and goes through all the way to a Dostoevsky novel. So we put it in the context of the upheavals and attempts at reform, both ill-conceived and well-conceived, of the early modern period of the scientific revolution of new ways of writing poetry. And I think they are shocked at some of the excesses of the French Revolution. We read an excerpt about the martyrdom of the Carmelite nuns. We read some documents describing the cult of reason that was instituted, where Notre Dame de Paris was converted into a temple to reason. There were all kinds of strange impieties committed in that cathedral in the name of reason. And so there's something just shocking about the break from the Christian past of Europe that is affected by the French Revolution. At the same time, we read analyses of the revolution from Burke and from Tocqueville, and we get a couple of different perspectives on it. And Tocqueville's quite interesting and has captured the students' attention in pointing out that the French Revolution was a long time coming, that the French Revolution was, although it turned its sights against the Catholic Church, was not originally conceived of as an anti-religious revolution, though it certainly became that. And I think they also enter sympathetically into the minds of a number of the protagonists. We read about the life of Louis XVI, and our students just feel bad for him. It seems like he was the absolute wrong man for that time and for that position. And it's hard to know what one would do differently if you were in that position and if you had that temperament and had that personal history. And so there's an attempt to enter sympathetically into the decisions that were made by the protagonists of this time. And there's also an attempt to see the significance of the revolution. And we'll be continuing later this semester with a few more reflections on the revolution and the tradition of revolution that it birthed from the French Revolution throughout 19th century Europe and even up to the Russian Revolution, which we'll look at towards the very end of our semester. Finally, they're all naturally curious about the relation between the French and the American Revolution And we teased that briefly in this class. We looked at the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen side by side with some American founding documents. And so we got a little glimmer of that, but we'll actually take that up more fully when they're seniors in their American Humanities class.
The late philosopher Roger Scruton wrote, quote, "The French Revolution sought to replace one religion with another, hence its fanaticism and exterminatory zeal. But the new religion of the nation was demonic, fraught with contradictions and self-hatred, with no power to survive. It quickly gave way to the Napoleonic project of empire." Close quote. Quickly, but not until more than 16,000 people were executed with trial and another 10 to 12,000 executed without trial, plus another 10,000 who died in prison, and all in the short period between September 5th, 1793 and July 27th, 1794. In Burke's words, quote, "When ancient options and rules for life are taken away, the loss cannot possibly be estimated. From that moment, we have no compass to govern us, nor can we know distinctly to what port we steer." Close quote. Not a comforting thought in our era. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.